Welcome to the Power of the Purse podcast, the only show that inspires baby boomer women to gain confidence around money so they can navigate life powerfully on their own. Here's your host, Lynn S. Evans, certified financial planner.
There was a time in my life not too long ago when I believed three things about money. One, women are not supposed to talk about or be included in any conversations about money. Two, women don't have the natural ability to understand anything about money. And three, men know best how to manage money. And those truths I made up about money guided me for years, until I realized money was not a foreign language or some other obscure academic exercise, and it was something I could not only understand, but teach to other women. Too many times I've heard stories from women who ought to know better but didn't, until they were forced to, because of divorce, widowhood, job loss, or the approach of retirement. My mission is to help women reduce their financial illiteracy and develop a healthy relationship with money. With that in mind, my guest today is attorney Barry Zahn. Barry is a tax attorney, business advisor, and general counsel, and has represented a broad array of multinational clients on U.S. and cross-border transactions across all industry sectors. She has supervised legal teams worldwide and has extensive management experience as the founder, former CEO, and general counsel of a nonprofit organization. Welcome, Barry.
Hi, Lynn. Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's a pleasure and a privilege to be here. I sound so important listening to that.
But you are. You are. You have to own that, girl. You have to say, I am all those things. I'm wonderful. First question I had, Barry, is what motivated you to become an attorney?
Oh, wow, that's a good question. You know, it's funny. I remember from very young watching legal shows and wanting to be an attorney. And my mom said, like, at a very young age, most kids put on a fire engine hat or something like that, a medical, outfit. But I took a briefcase and I wanted to be attorney. I don't know why, but I do recall wanting to make a difference. And that I, from a very young age, remembered thinking that if I could harness the law and use it to make a difference, that was very powerful.
Was there any one person that you knew who was an attorney that you really thought, wow, I want to be like him or her?
Not so much any one person, but there was, in my high school, I actually went to James Madison High School, where Ruth Bader Ginsburg went, as well as many other famous people in Brooklyn. And there was a law institute program. That program, it was a special program. And the firm that was the mentor for that program was Cadwallader, Wickersham, and Taft. And so during my senior year, we got to go to this phenomenal law firm down on Wall Street. And I just remembered being, walking into this incredible building and thinking, this is something I want to do. This is what I want for myself in my life.
Yeah, that's a wonderful moment of inspiration when you looked at the place and you started to get butterflies in your stomach and you say, yeah, this is it. That's a great connection. More importantly, you not only became someone who was an attorney, but you're also a tax attorney. And a tax attorney is something that's even richer as far as the amount of knowledge and the breadth of the scope of what you do. So what was it that attracted you to that type of law that you said, I'd like to do all this international stuff, mergers, acquisitions, all of that? How did the tax planning piece come up for you?
I tried everything. It was a complete accident. And I tried everything in my power not to do it. And it just, I was, my first job before I was a lawyer, I was a paralegal at Strook and Strook and Lavon. I went for, to look for a, another job after that, and it was for a legal assistant. And when I walked in the door, it was actually for J.K. Lasser's Your Income Tax Guide, and they were looking for somebody to help write the manuals. And I walked in, and I said, what is this? This is this tax guide. I said, thank you very much, no. And at that time, my prior boss, who was amazing, Elliot Ice, said to me, no, sit down. Do you like to write? Yes, I like to write. Do you like to read? Yes, take a test, write up this case. And I remember it was the home office deduction case, the Solomon case. And I wrote it up, and I loved it. I loved writing. And so, I ended up starting there, and I knew I wanted to go back to law school. I was going to leave. This is like maybe after 4 years and go back to law school. And Elliot said, well, would you consider going to law school at night? And I said, absolutely not. And he said, well, what if we gave you some money to go to school? And I was like, well, night school sounds great. And so that's what I did. And I always really wanted to be a litigator. I always thought that I would be a litigator. But because I went to school at night and worked full-time during the day, I was, I didn't have the opportunity as other people did, where they would go to, let's say, a firm during the summer. I always worked. So I had a lot of tax in my background. When I was applying for clerkships, to federal clerkships, I applied for every court that you can imagine. And I applied to the tax court, United States Tax Court, just as a backup, just in case. And, I had a lot of other interviews, but I got an interview with a couple of different interviews at the tax court, and Judge Carolyn Miller Parr interviewed me, and I got the tax court offer, and I accepted it. And it's funny, even when I went to apply for jobs after the 2-year clerkship, I tried to make my resume everything except tax. I said, a clerkship is a clerkship is a clerkship, and I'm going to make it litigation. And I got a lot of interviews and no offers. And I said, I guess, tax is for me. And I was really good at it. And in the end, after trying to fight it, I got a job at Sherman and Sterling, and it was one of the, top firms in the world in the tax department. And actually, I took it because it was the only one where they would let me do tax litigation, which is called tax controversy, and tax deals, M&A and corporate transactional work. And I did the tax controversy work for a year, and all it was sitting and writing briefs. And I was like, this isn't fun. I actually found out that I was a deal junkie. And I loved running the deals. I loved running the tax deals. And at that time, at Sherman and Sterling, it was just, things were booming. And I just ended up working with one of the top tax, international tax lawyers in the world, Peter Blessing, who now is pretty high up at the IRS International Tax. And he took me under his wing. And I just got an incredible experience working there, working with him, and quite frankly, all of the partners there. And I found that I loved it. People think that the tax law is what accountants do. It's filing tax returns, it's not. It's actually a puzzle. And, it's working, with companies that are coming into the United States, that are going outside of the United States, now working with people and global families. And it's really a puzzle. It's figuring out, how to structure something so that it's the most tax efficient for my client. And I, I'm the kind of lawyer that everybody loves. Most people don't like the lawyers. They have to pay them a lot of money. But with me, they pay me a lot of money, but I save them a lot more. So, that's, that's a great thing. Yep. So there,
There's a specific cost-benefit relationship in your work, right?
Yes. Yes. Definitely.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
So I tried to run from it, but it caught me.
I guess so. It grabbed you and said, you ain't going nowhere. I love the idea of what you're doing, because I think most attorneys will probably go the easy route, in the sense of, I'm an attorney and I'm looking to maybe do some estate planning or do some this or that. But I think tax planning is a constant challenge, because every time they change the tax laws in D.C., you've got a whole new world you have to deal with. So it never really ends.
That is definitely true. It's constantly changing. I mean, quite frankly, any regulatory area is like that. But that's what I think that's what I love about it. Again, it's really challenging.
Let's talk a little bit about something you mentioned when you said that you've done a lot of work with companies that are coming into or leaving this country to do work outside of the United States. That would probably lend itself to all of the information that's in your resume about your bio, whatever you want to call that, that talks about the cross-border. Yes, it's a lovely inclusive term, cross-border. So it's anything outside the United States or anything coming to the United States. So I noticed that you also mentioned that you had an office in China. How did that develop?
Well, it's actually not an office in China. It's a strategic alliance with a firm in China. But the attorney, one of the attorneys that works at that firm, also works under our auspices at the Zon Law Group. I guess my connection to China came about when I was at Kay Scholer. My kind of a sort of mentor, Alice Young, ran the Asia Pacific practice at Kay Scholer. She got me more and more involved with Asia. And then I had a client that founded the largest Chinese-owned and operated law firm. And he founded a real estate development company and didn't want to run the law firm anymore. He was my client. I was representing him at the time, being as a general counsel and doing some tax. And he didn't want to really focus on the law. And he said, come run my law firm. And, you know, I had only been at big law my whole life. But he really made me an offer that I could not refuse. And I did. And I went and I ran, I was the managing partner of the largest Chinese owned and operated law firm in New York. And I did that for 4 years. And actually through my time there is when I met Robin Capsan, who is the attorney that she's a U.S. attorney, has been living though in China for 20 some odd years. And we really formed a very strong bond. And she is my counterpart on the ground there in Shanghai. There's, you know, we really work hand in glove together. I work with the firm that she's at that has offices across all of China. So, and when Robin is doing U.S. work, she works under the Zon Law Group. So she straddles both. And she is my bridge, and it's been an incredible experience to have that opportunity to partner with Robin and Duan and Duan.
Did you have to learn to speak the language?
Unfortunately, I don't. I learned how to say Wo Yao Bin Shui, which is very important. It's I want ice water. reason that I want ice water is very important is because when you go to China, you'll know that they drink water warm sometimes, well, hot often, but even when they bring you, water just that's not hot, it's room temperature. They don't really think that ice is good in water. So I learned that. I learned that very quickly. And some other important keywords like, well, I need, which is I love you, which I think is an important thing to learn in every language.
Yeah. So you said that there was a lot of work there with the Asian area, Asia Pacific. Do you do more work outside of China? Do you do work with any of the other countries in Asia?
So I have clients throughout the world. I've represented clients from Japan, Korea, all over Europe, probably every continent, certainly Canada, because I worked for two Canadian law firms, South America. I think the only continent that I really haven't worked that much with is Africa.
And would you like to?
I would love to.
Okay. But the word is out.
I'd actually, I'd love to just go to it. I mean, my list of things, right, is a safari and just to see all of Africa where we all came from.
Yeah. Yes, we all did at one point. You have done a significant amount of networking, and I know that that's one of the things we have in common. It's the way that we actually met through one of our friends who's a master of networking. We have to give him a plug, Jack Killian. I was going to say rumor has it, but you know the source of all this when I say to you that he's said that you've put on some incredible networking events. So when you do this, obviously you didn't start with an A-list of people when you did your first networking event. So how did you learn, how did you ramp up your skills in networking to the point where it is what it is now?
That's a great question. I never think about it, first of all, as networking. I don't, that term doesn't resonate with me so much. I love people. And I guess it maybe started with my mother, who taught me that my job is to give and receive love and leave the world a better place than I found it. And that really has been, you know, who I am and how I operate, or at least try to. And so I think in terms of networking, I was always the person who, if somebody needed something and didn't know how to get it, they would call me. I would figure it out. I would put them in touch with somebody. I was always listening, right? Always listening. I was always asking questions. I remember my mother used to say, I was very close with my great grandmother, and I would ask her all sorts of questions about her life and what she did and where she was from, and always wanting to know. My mother's like, I didn't know anything about grandma, you know. So I love to ask questions and I love to listen. And when I do that, I really learn so much about people. And I remember, Lynn is looking to connect with this person, and I could, you know, maybe help them and be an asset. And that's really how it started. It's just putting people together.
Why don't you tell us about some of the wonderful networking events you've had? I guess they're at your office, or have they been held elsewhere?
You know, I've done all sorts of networking events. You know, recently, well, pre-COVID, I was, you know, having people meet in the mornings. And I was thinking about, again, you know, who would be a good person to meet the other? And I would, you know, bring a small group of people together. And replicate that. I was doing that over dinners, like small soirees. But then also I founded a charity. And so in memory of my uncle, who was like my brother, he was the first New York City school teacher to publicly disclose that he was HIV positive. And he had a show on New York One called AIDS, A Journal of Hope, where he documented his life and my family on television. For all the world to see. He died on television for all New Yorkers to see. But through him, I founded Living Beyond Belief and was very, very fortunate to have people like Alan Cumming and Rosie Perez and Daphne Rubin Vega and Marissa Tomei, and the list goes on of folks who knew Wayne or knew of him and wanted to be a part of the charity, which focused on raising AIDS awareness among youth in New York City and gave them college grants. And so I threw huge events through Living Beyond Belief and met an array of people in that sector. And I and then I guess, you know, also through different organizations that I've worked with, through the NGLCC, which is the National Gay and Lesbian Chamber of Commerce. I founded the Legal Industry Council, both at local in New York and national. So was responsible for throwing huge events for them. I did their first big fundraiser membership event in New York with my dear friend Elliot Joel Stern. So yeah, it's kind of second nature for me. I love a good party.
I'd say they're quite good parties from what I hear. Yeah, it's like you want to be on that list. And I'm sure that there are so many catering companies in New York that are probably going out of business because you can't do that anymore. I mean, I'm sure they're wonderful businesses in and of themselves, but I think that the kind of events that you've put on probably made a big difference in their bottom line.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you over the years, Cocktail Caterers, just to give a little shout out, they were my caterers for years. A great, great, great group of guys. And Liquid Labs is a wonderful mixologist company. The two owners are out of Hudson Yards. You can go online and get mixology classes now, even during COVID. So that's, But yeah,
that sounds like fun.
Hopefully we'll be able to do that again soon.
Okay, I'm hoping too, because I think we all want to get back to normal, but whatever that is. Let's talk a little bit about your involvement with the National Gay and Lesbian Chamber of Commerce. You were one of the original founders of that organization, is that correct?
One of the founders of their legal industry council. So I was involved with the organization in New York when the organization was founding. At the national level, it had already existed, and then the folks at National had asked some very close friends of mine to start it in New York, and then they came to me and said, Barry, we need a legal, we need an industry council, legal industry council. Would you be willing to start that for us? And so I did, and I did that in New York, and it grew very successfully. And then I was tapped by National to come and do that at the national level. And that was a phenomenal experience. And I did that and chaired that legal industry council at the national level for probably about 5 years, and then stepped down. And now I've actually gotten involved again. I took a little breather, but I'm back in action again. So I'm looking forward to rekindling that relationship.
Barry, let me ask you a question that I think most people who are straight would ask. Simply because there's a, as you had mentioned, a big misunderstanding about what all that means. And like we had talked earlier about what are all the acronyms mean and all that kind of stuff. And we were both a little unclear about it ourselves. But what is it that, and I say this because I think it's across all kinds of, let's call it segregated type organizations. Do we really need to have them anymore? Do we really need that separation?
I mean, that's a really good question. I think connectedness is very important. And ultimately, it would be wonderful if we could get to a place in the world where we don't need to say Black Lives Matter, right? Or, this is an LGBTQ or queer or fluid organization. But we're not there yet. And, until we get to a society where truly all people are equal, I think it is important. And I've spoken about this to the younger generation that'll say, well, why do you have to say LGBTQ? Why can't you just, why can't we just all be one? But I think it's very important for political reasons, for power, to be able to bring people together under that particular auspice, umbrella, if you will, or that particular group.
The reason I'm asking the question is because, all around us, no matter what it is, we always see news stories start by saying things like the first black this or that, the first woman this or that. And it just, it goes on and on and on. And the and there's the first transgender person. I think the thing that I find difficult to deal with when I hear that is I don't want myself to be defined by the first something or other. I would just like people to know me for who I am and what I do, because it seems to me that the more we accentuate the difference in each of us, the more that shows up first in the conversation. So if I didn't say that I was transgender, or I didn't, it's obvious you can see that I'm Black, but I mean, sexuality, whether I'm gay, lesbian, whatever all those other initials are, if I'm any of that, then why do you have to define me by that? I would prefer that you define me simply by what I do. And I wonder at what point in our history do we ever get to the point where we don't have to say that about people, the first whatever?
Well, I think the answer is when we don't have to do it anymore, right? When it won't even matter anymore, right? When people are not held back by the color of their skin or by their sexual orientation or, you know, sexual or gender identity, you know, I think that that's when we can hopefully finally stop having to do that.
Probably won't happen in our lifetimes, but I guess we can keep pushing towards that goal. It saddens me to see so much of that out there, but we know it's there. And so it is. I guess as long as that exists, we'll need something to counter it.
Right.
I have a question for you here. This is one you haven't seen. If you had all the money you ever wanted, what would you do with your time?
I would definitely spend more time with the people that I love. Mm-hmm. I would spend more time traveling all over the world, spend more time sitting still and reading a book, just the leisure of being able to just stop and read a book. Yeah, I think I'd slow down and take time to be with those that I love.
And I see you have some grandnieces.
Indeed.
I love it, because I just had a grandniece 3 days ago, so I'm just so excited. I can't wait to spend time with her. I love it. I love it. And then you also said that you like to dance. So what kind of dancing would you do?
Oh, I love to dance. I just love music. And it takes you back to a time and place or brings you somewhere else. It's funny that you said that, because I literally just said the other day, like that is a big thing about COVID. I really just want to go out and I want to dance. I love all kinds of music. I definitely love classic disco, but I love all sorts of music. I love, you know, hard rock. I love classic rock. I love hip hop. I love rap. If the music is good, it makes me move. It's just an incredible thing. And music is, I think, connects people together across cultures. So yeah, I would definitely, if I had all the money in the world, I would definitely find myself out dancing.
Good. Okay. So, you know, you don't need to have all the money in the world to go out and do that. So get going. Okay, let's make a transition here. I'd like to really get some idea of some of your experience with money. And I know you've seen some of these questions, so I would ask, what is your first memory around money?
So my first memory around money is probably... I remember I wanted a burgundy velour pair of pants. They were Sassoon. And my mother, you know, at that time, she was a single mom. My parents were divorced. And, you know, they were very expensive. And I remember her saying to me, you know, well, if you want that, you know, you're going to have to work for that. You know, I'll give you some money towards it. And that was always my mother's thing. I'll give you some money towards it and you have to go out and make the rest. And so I, you know, immediately started babysitting. I was like, okay, I could do that. And so that was, you know, got my first pair of Sassoon velour jeans.
All right. Nice taste. Okay. What lessons about money did you learn when you were growing up?
So, you know, my mom, in growing up, always, I remember her again, you know, because we were from a divorced home and she was a single mom. I remember her always sitting and figuring the bills and constantly figuring out a budget. And she was very responsible. So I learned to be responsible. And I learned from, as I said, from very young, it was always, well, if you put in this piece, I'll put in this piece. So, you know, I always worked during college. And, you know, she said, okay, if you want to live off campus, I was at NYU, I'll help you, but you have to contribute. And so I learned from a very young age that you don't live, you know, above your means and responsibility.
Okay. What would you say are some of the best and the worst financial decisions you've ever made?
So I think the best financial decisions I've ever made was to buy real estate very young. My great grandmother knew that I was going to go into law school and start and work. I was working all day and going to school at night. And she said, you know, you can't live in Brooklyn anymore. So I'll give you some money to buy an apartment. And it was also the same concept. You have to save a little towards it and I'll give you a little bit towards it. And so I bought my first apartment in Chelsea, I guess when I was like 22 years old. And then years later, I bought another one and combined the two together. And then I bought a third one upstairs that I was going to combine together and I ended up not, which I still have and I'm renting. And then my mom ended up becoming a broker and we've bought some places down in Florida. So those definitely real estate, I think overall has held up well. I know we're going through a rough time now with real estate, but it's, you know, it's been in the markets that I know that's been definitely one of the best things that I've done.
Okay. And the worst?
Probably the biggest mistakes that I made, I got approached by somebody to invest in a sensual emoji app called Plume. And I really loved the woman. She was great. And it was through a friend and it sounded all wonderful and like a smart thing to do. But, you know, in the end, that ended up not being a very good decision. Luckily, it wasn't a huge investment, but that definitely was not one of my high points. And then I think the other investment that I've made over the years and continue to make, and maybe it wasn't a smart investment, is there's this incredible designer, and he's really dressed every celebrity that you can possibly imagine, from Catherine Zeta-Jones to Eva Longoria, and the list goes on and on. His name is Gustavo Cadile, and he's just so talented and incredible designer and has won all sorts of awards. And over the years, you know, I've invested in him and kind of kept him afloat and, you know, and he's just, he's not a great businessman. We need to find a backer, a large company that would be interested in coming in and kind of taking over his business operation. So I don't know if it was the worst. I mean, it probably wasn't a good investment in terms of making money, but certainly in making a difference. And I believe in him. So I certainly don't regret it.
Okay. That sounds exciting.
But haven't made any money off of it.
Yet.
Okay. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Who was or is the most influential woman in your life, and what advice did she give you?
Hands down, it's got to be my mother. You know, my mother was a single mom raising me and my brother. You know, she really taught me that I could be whoever I want to be, I can do whatever I want to do, that you know, I have the power to change the world. And she made me believe that, you know, I had that base and that foundation from a very young age. And I really think that it's had a profound effect on who I am in the world. And I know that for myself, I can do anything I want to do if I put my mind to it. And I try to instill that same in all of the women that I've worked with over the years, that I've mentored, certainly my nieces and grandnieces in the family.
That's not a bad mentorship. It sounds pretty good. Make a difference in the world. I like that. On that note, let's wrap this up. So my thanks to my guest, Attorney Barry Zahn. And Barry, tell people how they can get in touch with you if they have additional questions.
Great. Well, thank you so much again, Lynn. This has been really a privilege and an honor. You can get in touch with me by going to bzahn@zahnlawgroup.com. That's BZAHN @zahnlawgroup.com. I really appreciate this. This was wonderful having this conversation with you to hopefully make a difference and inspire some women out there around money and freedom. Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. I think that we will make sure, we will make sure that we get this information out to all the wonderful outlets of podcasts so that women all over the world can hear this. And I, to all of you in my Power of the Purse community, I hope you enjoyed today's podcast. If you did, please go to iTunes.com, search for Power of the Purse, and leave a review. As always, I appreciate that. And thanks again, Barry, for sharing your time and your knowledge. And until the next time, thanks for listening. And remember, money is not the enemy. Your ignorance of it is. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to The Power of the Purse with Lynn S. Evans, a certified financial planner. Be sure to subscribe for more inspiring stories and information to help you take charge of your financial future. For more information, visit powerofthepursepodcast.com.